and tell you a lot more about how some of this new technology actually works and some of its potential, because that's really his area of expertise. Not my, I sort of have a kind of surface level understanding of some of the developments. And, so I think, that's kind of the point of the distinction between the two. So I'm going to touch on some issues and then I think Stephen's going to go into more detail. One of the things that get the technology working here. First. I did a presentation the other day and nothing worked because I transferred the presentation to another computer and all the links I built into the presentation didn't work, so the whole thing went to pieces. After that, I vowed to never make a presentation unless it was on my laptop. So I was going to say, this doesn't work. This is just an overview of what I want to talk about. I want to give you some, or make some comments, brief comments about the past, present, and a little bit about the future of online learning, but I'm going to leave most of the future stuff to Stephen. Talk a little bit about what the current state of online learning is, what tools and technology we are using currently. Talking a little bit about best practices in online learning, and then make some brief comments about the whole notion of generational differences and the sort of discussion that's going on now about how the current younger generation has very different needs and expectations, different and is positioned differently in terms of how they're using information communication technology. As I was preparing for this presentation and thinking about some of these issues, I realized that online learning is kind of in a peculiar state. At one time, online learning was on the leading edge. It was just considered quite groundbreaking just to be able to deliver education and training online. But what we've witnessed over the last few years is some significant changes in how we're using the internet to communicate, how we're using information communication technologies in general. We've seen the emergence of services like YouTube, which sort of emerged almost overnight and garnered millions of users and sold for billions of dollars. We're seeing blogging as something that is almost mainstream in terms of using it as a way of communicating. We really live in a world of global information communication mediated through the internet. And yet, despite all these changes that are going on in that realm, when we look at what's happening in online learning in general, and this is a generalization certainly, but if we look at it in general terms, we don't see a lot of change. It seems like online learning in many ways is stuck in a time warp. And just to illustrate that point, I've actually been involved in online learning since the beginning, since I taught in one of the first online courses, or the first online course that BBC ever offered. Back in 1997, and this is a screenshot of that course. And if you know anything about online learning, if you looked at online courses, that probably looks like a typical online course. And notice that it probably looks a lot like the CGA online courses that I just looked at in preparation for this. So that was 1997. If you move ahead almost 10 years to 2006, that's the course that I'm teaching right now. Every turn. Doesn't look a lot different. In fact, it's almost identical in terms of the structure, even though the software is WebCT, it's a different version of WebCT, but it's still WebCT, and it has the same functionality. In terms of its structure, it's essentially online presentation of text-based content, asynchronous text-based discussions, online submission of assignments. So amazingly little has changed over those 9-10 years in terms of online learning. And that's not just what's happening with that particular course and that particular institution. If you look at most post-secondary institutions in the world, online learning really hasn't changed a lot in those 10 years. And that's despite all these significant changes that have been going on in the other areas of internet communication. With that in mind, I thought this illustration quite revealing. This is a prediction of what learning would look like in the year 2008 and 1900. So you have, you know, the professor with his book grinding machine, which is powered by the student, grinding up all this content and then delivering it to the students through this some kind of headset contraption. And in many ways, that's where we are still with online learning. And admittedly, an exaggeration, but we really are still in that kind of delivery of content to learners mode. Even though we know that technology can do much more. The other thing that's interesting to note is that a lot of the predictions that are now being made about how things are going, how these new developments of internet technologies are going to revolutionize teaching and learning, those same kind of predictions were made back in the 1990s with the emergence of what was then called CMC, or computer-mediated communication. The argument then was that the characteristics of computer-mediated communication would lead to this paradigm shift from a teacher-centered to a collaborative learner-centered knowledge construction environment. And that was because of the anytime, anyplace, asynchronous, and the computer-mediated characteristics. But we didn't really see that happen. Not on a large scale, certainly. Some of that is going on, but in general, as I say, I think we're still in that kind of content delivery mode. And so similar claims are being now made about the new technologies that that you're seeing emerging. And I tend to have more hope that that actually will happen with these new technologies. And what some people are now saying is that we're moving from what's called an architecture of presentation, where the technology is being used to simply allow individuals and learners to access and download information and use it at their own leisure, to an architecture of participation, where not only can you download the information, access information relatively easily, but you can actually contribute to that and get involved in a kind of knowledge construction, knowledge building community. And this whole notion of architecture of presentation to architecture of participation is related to the idea of moving from Web 1.0 to Web 2.0. And the article that I took this information from, which I have on my list of references if you want it, talks about moving from learning environment 1 to learning environment 2. And I'm not going to read all these to you, but if you look at them quickly, you can see it's really about moving from the content delivery kind of mode, accessing information, to a really collaborative, learner-centered mode of learning and teaching. Another way of looking at the evolution of ICT that I find quite useful is the notion of that there have been three waves of information communication technology. Wave one was the idea that we call it technology as an imperative, that, you know, we have to do it because we need to prepare our students for the new knowledge economy, and so they have to get used to using technology. Wave two is a bit more sophisticated than that, in that we actually start to use the technology in ways that it's most appropriate. So we start to integrate a little bit into the curriculum rather than just using it for the sake of using it. And then wave three is the idea that sort of goes even beyond that, and we talk about it as ICT as an ordinance, looking at the specific characteristics of communication technology and using it in a way that actually allows you to do things that you wouldn't otherwise be able to do. And I think in many ways we're kind of at wave two, and maybe starting to move into wave three. I mean, the argument is that these new technologies are going to allow us to move to wave three if we take advantage of them appropriately in our educational institutions and educational context. So let me move on then. So that's just some comments on the past and the present and sort of where things might be heading. And I think Steve will probably want to talk more about that. But in terms of where we are today and what we're doing with tools and technology and online learning, it's really a learning management system-based kind of environment. The the learning management system, the WebCT, Blackboard on the kind of proprietary side, and the Moodle on the open source side, are what is at the core of most online learning at the moment. And what this means is that we have a whole suite of tools that are available in one self-contained online environment. We have content management, formatting, assignment submission, asynchronous discussion, synchronous chat, voice tools, and so on. You're probably familiar with those. Certainly, those are all the tools, I think, that I saw in the MCTA online courses. And that is the dominant model for skill for online learning. In terms of the instructional design model, the dominant model is really still, despite what people say, and there's a lot of talk about how this new online environment creates this sort of learner-centered, collaborative instructional design. But if you look at really what's going on, it really is, I think, fundamentally information transmission supported by some asynchronous online discussions, which, depending on how they're managed and designed, can, I think, result in that kind of collaborative and constructivist kind of learning. But by and large, I think they tend to be add-ons to support to what is fundamentally an information transmission type of design. Okay, so that's sort of where the current state of things. I think what we're seeing, though, is slowly an increase in the use of more advanced and creative tools, what I call social software, which Stephen informed me, I actually have a slightly different definition of that than he does, so he might explain it slightly differently, but what I call social software are basically tools that allow you to communicate and interact and contribute to some kind of learning network. And so we have things like blogs, and Stephen's going to talk that's not the blog facility. What happened to me last time? The links went the wrong way.
Maybe it was the links.
No, I checked. Anyway, blogs, which are essentially online journals that allow you to very easily publish your thoughts about anything. So we see this happening all over the place. We see people getting into trouble, politicians getting into trouble because they publish blogs that their leaders don't like. So blogs are becoming almost a mainstream form of communication. We see wikis, which are kind of one step beyond that, that not only allow you to publish your ideas, but allow other people to contribute to that. And so that slide that I showed you before, which is what I was trying to show you, was Wikipedia, which is the best known example of a wiki encyclopedia that is co-created by a world of users. Social bookmarking, which is things like Plural and Delicious, which allow you to collect all your URLs, bookmarks, and share those, and create a social network of similar users who have similar interests. And you can see what other people are like, and you can share them, make them available. I've actually been using that in online courses I'm teaching. That's actually quite a useful tool. E-portfolios is another tool that is being used increasingly in the online environment. Virtual worlds, that's something that I've just become interested in recently. And that is the whole Second Life is the prime example of that. So basically, if you don't know anything about it, it's just an online 3D virtual world that allows you to create a second identity and go in there and interact with other people. It's an entire world. They have their own currency, you can buy things. And what's interesting about that is that about 50 or 60 educational institutions have actually bought virtual real estate within this world and are considering using it for educational purposes. And we have actually some professors who are starting to teach or use it for teaching purposes.
How?
Well, that's a good question. I haven't actually been able to go in and see what they're doing. The interesting, the kind of disappointing thing in some respects is if you go in and look at some of the the educational areas that have been created, they are just just like lecture theaters and replicas of what you get in the real world. So some of what I see there doesn't encourage me that people are thinking about using this creatively. It looks like, again, replication of what's going on in the real world. But I think there are some instructors who are using it for role-playing kinds of activities. So if you can, if you take on a second persona or a second identity and engage role-playing activities, that's can be quite an effective educational tool, of course. So the question is, are these tools changing the dominant instructional design paradigm? Online delivery is still primarily text-based. The notion of a constructivist collaborative environment is still pretty well. The technology is really still being used primarily to replicate earlier modes of teaching, but I think there is some hope that these new technologies will change that. So that's a little bit about the current state and some things, areas we might be moving into. In terms of best practices, and I'll try to rush through this so we don't have too much time. One of the key best practices in my mind is the idea of how we develop online courses, and I think the whole notion of the project team is critical. The idea that you can do this thing on your own and an individual professor can create a quality online course on a sustainable basis over a number of years in an institution, I think is not feasible. And so using this project team approach where you bring together a team of experts, this is sort of an illustration of it, has been shown to produce the highest quality online courses. IDC there refers to instructional development consultants, just what we call them, what we call instructional designers, essentially IDC. The other key ingredient, critical ingredient in terms of best practices, are quality learner support, instructor development, instructor support, and technical support. And the research has shown pretty clearly that probably the most critical ingredient to a successful online course is the level of learner support that the learners receive. Learners will put up with just about anything, bad technology, bad interface, bad instructor, but if they get the support that they need at the critical times, if something goes wrong and they can get a hold of somebody to fix it, that tends to outweigh just about everything else. Instructor development is critical. We can't expect that to drop instructors into this new kind of teaching environment without properly training them and giving them opportunities to learn how to do it effectively. And that means more than just one-time training. It means ongoing support. And of course, technical support. You have to have that. If things go wrong, students need to be able to get a hold of somebody to fix situation right away. It's not good enough to say that the help desk is closed on weekends to call back online. And that's one of the problems that traditional institutions face because they are not geared towards that kind of 24/7 technical support. It's quite a different situation to deal with online. Organizational issues in terms of best practices, the whole notion of a strong central support within an institution is critical. This is probably less relevant to your situation because I'm talking about an educational institution, but you really need to have that central support. The idea of the Lone Ranger just is not sustainable. Okay, I want to just conclude with some comments about the whole notion of generational differences and the idea that there is this, that the new younger generation has a very different outlook on life and very different needs, and these have some impact on how we design education and how we design online learning as well. And there's been a lot of talk about this, the whole idea of Generation Y, people that were born in the late 70s and early 80s. the interesting thing about this generation is that they are a group of people who have never known life without all these technologies, cell phones, pagers, fax machines, voicemail, internet. The part that I find I'm always a little skeptical about is when we start to read what are the characteristics of this generation. This comes from an article that I found and I got the reference if you wanted. And they argue this, or he argues that the characteristics of this generation are that they're impatient, adaptable, natural innovators, skilled time managers and multitaskers, skeptical, risk takers, independent thinkers, tolerant of individual differences, team players, committed and loyal. I'm not sure if that's any different than any other generation, but in any case, that is the argument that this group of young people, that's their profile. Continuing on with that, this generation likes challenges, opportunities to create and innovate, immediacy and feedback, clearly defined tasks and expectations, technology, collaboration and teamwork, being respected as individuals, and they like to challenge assumptions. Part of the reason I have a problem with this is that I have two daughters, 19 and 24, and a lot of this just doesn't get.
Still at home, are they?
Well, that's not true. Not right now. So the question is, how accurate is that portrayal of Generation Y? One of the arguments is that a generation is defined by the issues it faces in its youth and experiences, which makes sense. But I think that's probably the more important issue, is that we need to recognize that you know, regardless of whether those characteristics are accurate, each generation is going to have its own unique characteristics and its unique challenges, and its this generation in particular is dealing with changes in technology that we haven't seen before, and dealing with issues that we haven't seen before, and that's bound to have some impact on how we treat them as learners. So the question then is, what are the educational implications, and more particularly, what are the implications for how we design online learning opportunities? So I'm going to stop there so that Stephen has time, and so you have time to ask us questions at the end. I do have this presentation, if you're interested, in a copy. That's made available. Thank you.
Yeah, it's the easiest way to go. Okay, I forgot what the name of the presentation was supposed to be, so I just typed this up quickly, but it's close. I'm going to follow on what he said, and I've got the whole program, but I think I can characterize the difference between what has been happening in e-learning and what's going to happen very simply and quickly, and it's right here. What I'm doing right now is, as I give this talk, I'm recording it. This is an iRiver, and if you look closely, you can see it says, now recording. I'll ask him later for permission to put his stuff up. I will be taking this recording, it's in MP3 format, later on, hopefully at the airport, because they now finally have internet access in the airport. Hopefully there I'll be uploading it to my website, and it will be available to be listened to by everyone who's interested in this topic around the world sometime later this evening. That's e-learning. That's where it's going. And we can tell, we were talking last night, we can tell that this is the direction in which it's going, because this is what's being blocked. This is what's being made illegal. This is where the institutions are turning off the switch. And if you actually have to take steps to prevent something from happening, it's probably the future. I was going to show you some stuff, speaking of preventing things from happening, I was going to show you some stuff online here. I chose not to, because this hotel would charge
$300 for one internet account. And again, when you find something that is being blocked, in this case by a ridiculous price, it's probably the way of the future. I'm sort of surprised that I would see a whole room full of people without computers out and reading their email and messing around with wikis or taking photographs or recording their own version of events. It's coming. It's coming. Once things like this ridiculous price barrier are broken, it'll come. I'm surprised people pay that. I can't imagine that people pay that. No human would pay that. But there it is. A blog, as was just mentioned, is, but a lot of people talk about it as an online journal or something like that, but a blog is most easily recognized by its format. It is a series of articles. These articles are dated. When you go to a blog, you see the most recent article first. When you start to read a blog, you just start reading down the blog until you hit something you've already read and you're caught up. So it's like a journal, but it's not necessarily a journal. A blog has a wide range of uses. We've seen blogs, as mentioned, used in politics, and effectively or not effectively, that's your call. We've seen them used as journals and personal diaries. We've seen them used to report on the news. A major category of blogs is war blogging. You can guess what that's about. And we've seen blogs used in learning and learning technology. What makes blogs blogs, what makes them the thing that they are, isn't the format or the characteristics or the content or anything like that. What makes blogs blogs is they are ridiculously easy to create. If I had internet access here, I could teach you all to do a blog in about 2 minutes. And if you all had your computers with your wireless access, you would all have your own blogs in about 10 minutes. And 10 minutes, 9 of which would take trying to come up with a name for your blog. Blogs have been used in learning, or it's over the last couple of years, they've been widely used in learning. The year that ended in June was probably the breakout year. This year now, it's becoming really mainstream. We have tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of classes blogging out there. They began as a replacement for an instructional web page or a teacher's web page, a class web page. And then as time went by, the teachers started putting links on their blogs. And then as time went by, because you can comment on blogs, they began to be used to organize in-class discussions. One of the neat things about a blog that's very different from a learning management system is an LMS puts the content here, the discussion here. Which is kind of weird when you think about it. It'd be like, after I'm done, if we all got up, went over to the next room, that's the discussion room, that's where we'll talk. Blogs put the discussion right, the content. You read the content, you click on the link, you're talking. And so they were unnatural for in-class discussions. And a lot of instructors, not wanting to go through all the fuss and the bother of a learning management system and all the overhead and logging in and all that stuff, they just use a blog. It's so simple, it's easy. And then as people began to get more used to them and students began to have their own blogs, they were putting their own resources up, they began to organize things, they began to organize themselves, have their own seminars, their own link exchanges, their own homework exchanges that they wouldn't talk about. And eventually the blogs became almost embedded in as part of the coursework or the assignment. Now you sort of see what happened, right? It's this, like, almost this underground technology, really easy, really non-corporate, just sneaking in. It's like it's down here. The LMS is still there, and that's what they're still officially using, but the interesting stuff's happening on the blogs. Major types of blogging systems, I named 4, there are more. Hosted means that the blog actually sits on somebody else's machine, and you access it over the internet. 2 major examples of that are Blogger and LiveJournal. Those were the 2 earliest into the arena. TypePad is another. There's a few more. Microsoft has one. MSN's, no, not Spaces. I forget what it's called. Nobody uses it. No, I'm kidding. The other type is server-based. That's where you get some software off the internet. Usually it's free software, although Movable Type has a commercial version. You install the software on your own web server, and then you access it, again, over the web, but off of your own machine. Related to blogs, and not talked about nearly as much as blogs, but in my view, equally influential, have been content management systems. Content management systems are almost like blogs for groups. They're more full-featured. You have multiple people having an account on a single space. You can have different types of content in different modes. Different systems call them differently. In Drupal, for example, the different types of content are called blocks. And so you can have a block which is a search, and a block which is, you know, recent articles, block which is stories, whatever. PostNuke, Scoop, Drupal, Plone, and again, there are a few others. What's interesting about these systems is that they are, again, free, they are open source, they have large development communities. In my opinion, I've looked at a lot of content management systems, including commercial ones that companies usually buy. These are by far and away better systems, much better systems. They're easier to use, they're faster, and they look nicer on the page. There are hundreds, thousands, probably tens of thousands of Drupal and PostNuke and Plone-powered websites out there, especially in the academic era, in the academic, not era, arena. If I were building a new website right now, I'd use something like Drupal. A wiki was mentioned is similar to a multi-user content management system, except that, well, there's no management. In a wiki, the principle of a wiki is that anybody can go in and change content on a page. You have a single page, it's edited by multiple people. Wikipedia is the most famous, it's also the largest. Nature, the journal, did a study showing that Wikipedia is roughly equivalent in accuracy to Encyclopedia Britannica. Has many, many more articles, millions of articles. It has many, many more readers, and it's certainly more up-to-date. Oops. Now, one of the things that happened, this actually began in 1997, 1998 or so, with an invention by Netscape. But what's happened is blogs, right now, if you think about a blog, you sort of think of it standing alone. But a number of services came on stream, because there are millions of blogs, hundreds of millions of blogs. And what they did is they started gathering the content together and aggregating the content and displaying it in one place. So you would get sites like PopDex, BlogDex, JPop, and that would list the top 5 or the top 10 blog posts that are out there. And they would rank them based on the number of links that they received from other blogs. Right now, probably the leader in this market space is Technorati. Although, you know, it's a fairly tight market space in my view. The way they did this, except for Technorati, which I find very interesting, is using something called RSS. RSS originally stood for Rich Site Summary. It was a format developed by Netscape, like I say, in 97, 98, and it was intended for personalized web portals. Netscape abandoned it. Quite literally, it took the pages right off their website, just gave up. But the community did not, myself among them, and different versions of RSS began to be developed over time. RSS 0.91, RSS 1.0, at which point it was called RDF Site Summary, because it was supposed to be part of the semantic web. And then a little later on, RSS 2.0, which was called Really Simple Syndication, and it was a response to RDF Site Summary, because the semantic web is really complicated, but RSS isn't. RSS is really simple. It's an XML, which means all that means is standard machine type description. XML file that contains 3 elements. The name of an item, the location of an item, and optionally, a description of an item. Actually, the location is actually optional too. Actually, so is the name. But usually all three, they have all 3 of those. And by item, what I mean is, well, a blog post, for example, or as Netscape originally intended, periodical articles like news stories in newspapers or magazine articles, anything that would come out frequently and that would change a lot, anything dynamic. RSS is being used for everything today. For learning resources, which is my area of interest, most of the major learning object repositories have an RSS feed listing new items being created. All of the blogs, MySpace accounts, and many other services that I'll talk about in the next few slides here. So what happens is, if you have an RSS reader, and I've mentioned blog lines here, although there are many others, what you can do is, what they say, subscribe to an RSS feed. And what that means is, your reader will access someone else's RSS. It'll bring in the RSS, and now you're reading somebody else's blog, but here in your reader. You might think, well, what's the point of that? Well, your reader can be used to read hundreds of blogs all at once. And so it's really fast. You don't have to go searching website after website after website. Is there any new content? I don't know. Check your email. I don't know. You just open up your reader and everything is right there. I read hundreds of websites a day. And it's easy. It doesn't take me any time at all because it's all right in the one same place. Kind of like reading the newspaper, except the newspaper was written by 300 or so people that I don't know. Then I guess that is kind of like the newspaper, isn't it? You take all this together and you get a model that looks a bit like this, where you have producers of content, people who write blogs, people who write news articles, people who create educational resources, and then you have the aggregators of the resources. That's the services that bring them together, like blog decks or pop decks or whatever, or the RSS readers, like blog lines, and again, there are many other RSS readers. Google has one that I've been using recently, actually. And then consumers, that's you and me, who subscribe to the aggregators and read our content. And then the feedback comes in the form of, if we blog about the stuff that we read, or if we subscribe or unsubscribe to something, or if we put a comment in on somebody's blog post, all of this counts as feedback. The feedback is really important. Those of you who've studied computer science will recognize that this is a neural network. And in a neural network is a type of self-organizing computer system. They're used to recognize trends, patterns, and clusters. In other words, to do recognition-type tasks, which typical artificial intelligence can't do. In neural networks, a major function is called backpropagation, and that's what the feedback does. The backpropagation alters and corrects the form or the shape of that network. Now, all of this happened and was happening around 2002, 2003, and then the ground began to shift. And now we're moving into some of the stuff that you've been hinting at. What we got, and it's become big now, is something called Web 2.0. And what Web 2.0 is a change in our perception of the web, a change in the way we approach what the web is. Sorry, gotta have my tunes. The original idea, Web 1, if you will, was like, the web was like, you know, 50 million TV channels. You'd log on, you'd read, you'd consume. It was media, right? You'd look for video, you'd look for images, you'd read stuff. That's what people did. Online learning, what is the web? You put up a bunch of content, all your online courses, crank, 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 right? That's the old way. What Web 2.0 is the web not as the place where you consume media, but as the place where you do stuff. There's the shift from we do it for you to we do it ourselves. You've heard of YouTube recently, probably. That video site where people upload videos, people upload their own videos. They don't wait for the movie theaters or the TV shows to produce videos for them. They produce their own videos. People have talked about, oh yeah, there's so much copyright theft and all of that on YouTube. You go to YouTube, actually go there and look at video after video after video, you're very hard-pressed to find copyright violations. I can't find them. I've sat there and watched it like all night and seen only original content. And that's the real threat to media of YouTube. People are creating their own media. And they're creating it like crazy. For photos, there's a site called Flickr. Flickr allows you to upload your photographs. Flickr, combined with a licensing system called Creative Commons, has allowed people to post photographs that anyone else can use in their own production. There are 20 or so million photographs now that are available to be freely reused by anyone. If you're in the business of selling photographs, get out of that business. Music, or any sort of audio, including this audio. There's something called podcasting. What podcasting is the recording of something, anything, music, sound. I recorded bird sounds in Africa. And then you put that in MP3 format. You take that MP3 formatted file and you put it on your website, and then you put a link in an RSS file. Naturally, there's RSS, right? This RSS file is subscribed to by people who have podcast readers. What the podcast reader does is it gets the address of your MP3 file, and while you're sleeping, it gets the MP3 file, it puts it on your iPod. And you get your iPod in the morning, you turn it on, you get in your car, you do your commute, you listen to the stuff that your podcast machine captured last night. Very automatic, very simple. The main thing is it's simple. People are using this instead of radio these days. Mob blogging is the same sort of thing. It's people who blog on the road, on the run. When you're podcasting, for example, Odeo used to be able to do this, but they just stopped in the last week. You could phone Odeo and phone in your podcast. You didn't even have to be online. Or you see people with the phones, with the camera phones, right? People taking pictures. People take pictures and post those pictures on their blog. If you see people walking around like this, they're taking pictures of you. You might not know it, but you're on the web. Collaborative blogging, as was mentioned before, where people create bookmarks and share their bookmarks. And this has led to full-fledged social networking. This is why I use the term slightly differently. A social networking site is a site where you have your own presence, a personal homepage, and then you create a list of people, sometimes called buddies if you're AOL, but usually called friends. And so you have a bunch of friends, and then they have a bunch of friends, and they have a bunch of friends. And what that does, basically, is it creates something that looks like this. Well, no, not a bad PowerPoint slide. It looks a lot like that, except with people rather than resources. So there's a lot more, I think, that's going to happen there. Like I say, been a lot of stuff happening in weblogs and similar technologies and learning, weblogs at Harvard Law, weblogs at UPEI. Educational Bloggers Network, which is James Richardson, who's just come out with a book. Digital Divide Network, which is Andy Carbon, or it was. Blogmeister is another one. Now, you take all of this and mash it together, and what you get is what I call the semantic social network. And what it is it takes social networking, theories of social networking, the idea of how content and information and knowledge moves through a mesh of connections, much like that picture that I had. And the theory that underlies how information is transferred and acquired in such a network is the same theory, the same mathematics, the same computation as connectionism in computer science, or neural networks in biology, physiology, self-organizing networks. Now what's happened in online learning is that from a basis in constructivism, from a basis in student-centered learning, a theory has emerged which blends student-centered learning and learning in this network type of framework. It's called connectivism. Connectivism, the term was coined by George Siemens, although the actual theory was developed, I would say, by a larger group of people, basically depicts knowing and learning as, I don't want to say social activities, because I don't like saying it that way. George would say it that way, but I don't. But as network activities. The idea here is that knowing happens in a network environment. What you know doesn't exist just in your head, but exists in your set of connections. In other words, who you know really does become what you know. George likes to say, I keep part of my knowledge, I store part of my knowledge on the internet. So The idea of learning in an environment like this is to be continually learning, continually making these connections, nurturing these connections, understanding how knowledge flows through the connections and the part that you play in that. If you want a concrete example of this, think about flying a 747 from Toronto to Munich. Does anyone know how to do this? Well, if you look at it, if you think about it, no one person knows how to make a 747 fly from Toronto to Munich. Because first of all, you have to build the 747. This turns out to be hard. Who knew? Right? It takes a variety of skills. Somebody needs to know how to make tires. Somebody needs to know how to make windows. Somebody needs to know how to make, you know, the big frame kind of thingy and the wings and the engines and Rolls-Royce or whatever. And then somebody needs to be able to put all of this stuff together in such a way that it doesn't fall apart. And then somebody else needs to figure out how to take it off. And somebody else needs to figure out how to navigate the thing. And somebody else needs to figure out how to serve coffee to people in turbulence without spilling it on them. And other people need to know how to land it successfully. No one person can do all this. No one person could possibly do all this. The knowledge is distributed. And understanding that the knowledge is distributed means that our approach, our thinking about knowledge, changes shape. It means that knowledge isn't something that looks like an object that you just take and plop into somebody's head like that picture. It means that knowledge is something dynamic that you tap into. This leads to something that I call learning networks. Take all of this, put it together. You have this very large web of user-generated content, not just learners, but all professionals in all different fields. This content exists in the context of social networks and communities. And that means that this network sort of swirls around in this community layer. Learning, and indeed knowing and creating new knowledge, becomes a process of aggregating this knowledge, remixing it, repurposing it, and feeding it forward. And this leads to the model of technology that is going to replace the learning management system. This is not just me saying this, it's being built right now by other people, people who are actually good at programming. Here's the picture. This is the future VLE picture. This is a very, by now, very famous picture. Future VLE, what we're calling that now is personal learning environment. And the idea of the personal learning environment is you do your learning here. And this personal learning environment does not necessarily sit on an institutional website or anywhere. It could sit on your own computer. And the main thing about it is it's yours. It belongs to you. You, the learner. You run it. And the way it's set up is it connects to resources spread out across the web, distributed in the same way the knowledge of how to build a 747 is distributed. Same structure. You have blog posts, live journals. You have to-do lists, 43 things. You have photographs and other images, Flickr. You have photographs, oh, I just said that. You have moving photographs, videos, so on. And the idea is that you access all of these things from your VLE, but your VLE is not just a content consumption tool. This is very important. The VLE is where you bring this stuff to play with it. It's where you bring in photographs to make new photographs, or where you bring in some photos and some text to make something new, or you bring in some video and some other video and do what they call a mashup. You join these things together. You create in your VLE. And then you use the same system to put this new stuff back out into the same network from which you got it, thus forming your part in this conversation. And that's what connectivism is. Learning as conversation. Learning as being part of the conversation. Thomas Kuhn used to talk about scientific revolutions, and he depicted knowing. What is it to know a science? Knowing a science, he said, is knowing how to solve the problems at the end of the chapter. And what that means is knowing a discipline is being able to converse in a discipline, being comfortable in that discipline, being able to be part of the community of practice of that discipline. This is the stuff that's being developed now by different people. It's the overall architecture. This is my dining room. Resource profiles. That's all the protocols, the XML protocols, including RSS, that will govern the interactions. Resource production, like your photo creation tool, your video creation tool, this kind of thing. Repositories, being the online storage places or libraries where you keep your created stuff. Resource aggregation, which is like the harvesters or aggregators that bring these things together. Rights, digital rights, not digital rights management. In a system like this, digital rights management is breakage, it's blockage, it's things that make it not work as well. By rights, I simply mean knowing who created the thing. Digital rights expression, in other words, keeping track of the provenance or the ownership of something, but not imposing some kind of technological measure. A common environment, this is your personal learning environment. I did this chart before we came up with that term. Syndication, this is the putting of your content back out into the network. Community, this is the social networking part, where your content goes out to other people. In the first instance, to those people who are your friends, and then to their friends, and then to their friends. See how the picture is different? Old web 1.1, one person broadcasts, like me. Everyone listens, like you. Web 2.0, everybody gets to talk, everybody gets to listen. The picture of online learning that emerges from this is a very different picture. You talked about courses. The future of online learning is not going to be based on courses. It's not even based on courses now. If you look at what's happening, especially in the corporate environment, you're seeing smaller, shorter, more directly relevant bits of knowledge, not a 40-hour course or anything like that. The model, and a lot of people are adapting this model, is of a learning environment as an ecology, where you don't try to make everything fit together like they're parts of a machine, but you put things in a space, like the palm and the horse, palm tree and the horse. Palm tree was not designed for horses. Horses were not designed for palm trees. Two very different ecosystems, yet they coexist and can be found in the same environment. And they are there simply by virtue of being placed there. Well, the horse placed more so than the palm, which may have just grown naturally. And so this is where you get the kind of model of learning that you're going to get in things like online games, electronic performance support systems, simulations, and the like, where you're doing something and the learning is simply available. It is simply placed in the space. Talking about Second Life, how do people do stuff in Second Life? I know how they do stuff in Second Life. They get a whole bunch of people together, they create a lecture theater, and then in Second Life, they can create a video, and they play a video. And that's learning in this virtual online environment. It's just like, it's the old way again, right? The way learning will happen in games is the way it really is happening in games when educators aren't involved, where the learning is just part of the game. Where when you need to know how to do something, the learning is just there. Play one of these online games, Civilization or that baseball game. I like that baseball game. You want to learn how to do something? F4, it'll tell you. Or F whatever. So, and that's the model of learning that we're going to be looking at in the future. And we'll talk probably a bit about assessment, but even assessment. Assessment won't be tests, how do you do well in a test? It'll be, did you succeed at the game? Did you master the simulation? Were you able to complete the task? The proof that you are able to do something will be the fact that you did it. Some papers. You'll be able to find this presentation and this recording sometime in the future, certainly by Monday, on my website at downs.ca. And thank you so much for your time. And we're into discussion now, which will be recorded. So remember, there's evidence. Or I could turn it off.
Yeah, I just want to check with how we're going to do it.
If you don't want it recorded, just say, please turn off the recorder, and I'll turn it off.
Turn it off.
Web 1.0.